welcome to Focus on Community. I'm Dr. Elaine Schroeder, and we are live on the air tonight for this month's edition of a radio program dedicated to informing Southeast Alaska K2 listeners about a myriad of psychological and social issues confronting us in our daily lives, and hopefully ultimately about living our lives with more awareness and greater happiness. Well, we're all getting older. That's definitely a fact. And for those of us over 60, we're really noticing changes that are both physical and perhaps cognitive. For some people, aging is depressing or frightening. For others, it could be a time of letting go or a time of freedom. Freedom from careers and child raising, for one thing. In one study I read on attitudes towards aging, the majority of respondents who were in their 80s said that the best time of their life was when they were in their 60s. So I presume that these folks were healthy and financially secure when they were in their 60s. But as lifetime development psychologists note, there's old age and then there's old age, where mobility is limited and illness sets in. So whether you are over 60 or have a parent who is, tonight's show will be right on target. So in the studio with me tonight, I have Sandy Harris and Nils Dila, who, with their combined experience counseling aging adults and their families, are perhaps Juno's most knowledgeable professionals on this topic. Welcome to Mind Over Matter, Sandy and Nils.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Really glad to have you here. I'm going to start with Sandy, just to give our folks, our listening audience, some background about where your professional experience around this topic has been. So what is your history of working with older folks, Sandy?
I started working at the Juno Pioneers Home as the social worker when the Pioneers Home opened in 1988. I did most of the admissions of residents there and counseling with families and residents until I retired from there in 2005. So I've seen almost a whole generation of Junoites who went into the Pioneers Home and what that was like for them. After I left the Pioneers Home, I went to work at Hospice and Home Care, again as a social worker, and spent time counseling with older adults and with people who had terminal illnesses. Since then, I've done a small private practice and do a little bit of consulting in the community. I'm mostly retired now.
Okay. And I want to add that Sandy co-led the bereavement group with me, the hospice-sponsored bereavement group. And just to put a plug in for that, we'll be starting up the bereavement group. It's an 8-week group, unfortunately without Sandy because she's not working for hospice anymore. But I will be doing the bereavement group starting in March. So if you want to sign up, either call me, Elaine Schroeder, and I'm in the phone book, or call hospice and home care, and they'll sign you up for the group.
And I'll put in a little plug for the group, too. It's a really wonderful group. It probably isn't something that people are eager to start, but once you get started and have some support going to deal with grief and adjustment, and it's really been a wonderful group.
It's been really great. We do it twice a year, and I would say the feedback from it has been pretty good.
Yeah, people make some nice connections with each other.
Really nice connections. So, Nils, what kinds of issues give me a little of your background as a counselor with Southeast Senior Services.
Okay, Elaine, thanks. It's kind of interesting. In a sense, I almost fell into working with older people because I had worked for many years with children and people of various ages, but I didn't really focus on old people. After I retired from the school district, there was this position open, and it was counseling at Southeast Senior Services for seniors. And I applied for it, and it was a 3-year grant cycles. So I thought I'd try it, see what it's like. I got the job, and that was 15 years ago. But when I look back about it, I kind of remember as a youngster, I would frequently wind up on a fishing bank next to an old person, talking to him, and having old relatives that I would hang out with. So it kind of makes sense that I fell into it, and and I enjoy it, and I've been doing it for quite a while now.
So what are your services?
Southeast Senior Services, as far as counseling goes, provides. I'm a one-person show there as far as the senior counseling goes. I am available to work with anyone who's a senior, and that's a person 60 years and older, for free, and I do home visits. And I also work to a certain extent with caregivers of people who are over 60.
Okay. So you counsel older people over 60.
Mm-hmm.
And what kinds of issues come up, Nels, with your senior clients? Say that would be distinct from working with people who are middle-aged or younger?
Yeah. A senior is like anyone, can have a full range of issues that they are dealing with. But I would say seniors tend to face a lot of losses. So it's like a loss of their ability to drive, the loss of their job, maybe having to move, maybe a spouse dies. So it's dealing with these losses, which often involves having to deal with the resulting depression and anxiety. So I would say there's a fair amount of depression and anxiety in many seniors.
And one thing you said, which was a tip-off to depression, is complaining about aches and pains.
Oh,
you said
okay. That's
sometimes a tip-off that somebody might be depressed.
Right. A 40-year-old might say, boy, I really feel depressed. My wife left me, and I just feel down and dumb, so I just feel worthless, and mm-hmm. I just feel like I'm not good for anything. Many times a senior, they won't say that so much. And what frequently will show there is just kind of these vague aches and pains, and it's kind of hard to nail down what's causing that. That can be a little tricky, though, because as we get older, we do also tend to have aches and pains, sore knees and so forth. But
Nels, young. Go on, Sandy.
I wanted to just mention that I think over the last 20, 30 years, some of the stigma has gone away from depression somewhat. And I've noticed mm-hmm. with older people as well as with younger people, people are more willing to say, well, yeah, I think I might be depressed.
Right.
And they see it more as an illness rather than a moral failing. Yeah. And that's been a real positive development, I think.
And that's been a challenge a lot with the older generation because, they're, post-depression, post-World War II type people. They were raised not to complain and not to seek out mental health.
Absolutely.
Services. So I guess it was okay to just talk about your aches and pains, but you don't really want to say, I'm depressed.
Ah, yes, I see. It's mm-hmm. a way of expressing
mm-hmm.
your unhappiness.
But like Sandy was saying, I think it's becoming more and more okay to say that. The stigma is being lifted, hopefully.
See, sir, you mentioned grieving. I think one aspect of aging is definitely the inevitable losses you experience. One experiences your eyesight gets worse, your hearing, you may need hearing aids, your knees are going, your mobility is decreased. I mean, there's no question that these things happen, and even physiologically more rapidly. For example, as I understand it, say between the ages, that the physical changes between, say, 40 and 50 are far less than the physical changes between 60 and 70 or 70 and 80. So it's occurring pretty rapidly. And those are all little deaths. And then there's the big loss, which is one's professional identity. So you're dealing with people who are post-retirement, who do not have the structure of going to work, of that kind of sense of meaning in their life. And do you find at all that some of your counseling gets almost existential or philosophical, and it's about life meaning, like what makes a life worthwhile? Do people ever get to that point in your counseling?
Well, I think it's important to help people identify strengths and the things that remain. I mean, you're right. People are mourning the loss of their friends. I mean, their world is disappearing around them, and their world is getting smaller as they become less able to get out. And it's really important, I think, to look inward to the person and to identify the things that have always been there, the things that people have accomplished, the things that have the most meaning in their lives. I mean, more and more people talk. It was always interesting to me. People don't talk about their jobs and how wonderful their careers were. They talk about their families.
Yes.
They talk about their relationships and really focus on some of the things that provide real wealth and richness to a life.
Yeah. So once a career is over, it's over.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think Sandy is touching on something important there, and you brought up a good question. And I think as seniors, as we all get older, and our time on Earth becomes less, there is a kind of a striving to see what was my life about, what was the value in my life, what was really important to me, what did I do, and to come to some kind of grips with that. So that's maybe that existential, you know, kind of what
absolutely.
Is this all about?
Absolutely. Was my life meaningful? Mm-hmm. You used the word striving, and one of the things you can let go of is striving for a career and that kind of striving. On the other hand, examining as your life, the length of your life is clearly limited and shortens. What did I contribute? What was the meaning of my life? And I recall a recent article I read that talked about as people are dying, those who go more softly into that dark night appear, were reported in the study, to have a greater sense of being okay about their life, being at peace with things, feeling that their life was meaningful. And people who were angry about leaving this earthly life seemed to be those who had lots of unfinished business, were very hard on themselves, truly felt they had hurt other people. Mm-hmm. And I remember in Tuesdays with Maury, the book, if you're familiar with it, by, I think, Mitch Abloom. Mitch Abloom. Maury emphasized he was dying of ALS slowly, slowly as it moved up his body, and he was giving wisdom to Mitch, the author. This is a true story. And I remember one thing he said is what's real important is to forgive.
Mm-hmm.
And I could see a counselor being able to bring this up, to forgive those who have, as they say in the Catholic Church, trespassed against us, who have hurt us, mm-hmm. and to forgive ourselves for things we did in the past that we regret. Does that come up, Nels?
I think a lot of times working with older people, they want to talk about the past. And you know, you kind of hear the jokes about, they're always talking about the old days. They're always talking about the past when people talk about seniors. Well, many times that's their way of trying to put things together to try to get us their own little survey of what their life was about. So many times when I'm working with people, seniors, it's kind of like they want to explore what they did. And I think those who come to the conclusion that, you know, yeah, sure, they made some mistakes, but you know what, I did the best I could. And you know, as we talk about it, you know, you try to get them to look at some of the positive things that happened. And if they can come to the conclusion that, I did the best I could, I did some good things, I did some things that maybe I could have done better, but I didn't do that on purpose. You know, I was doing what I could, and then to forgive themselves and to forgive others, I think that brings a peace about that
right.
helps them prepare themselves.
And you're working, Sandy, with even older adults you mm-hmm. have, both with hospice and at the Pioneer Home. Do people talk to you about that?
Yeah, it's really wonderful when you can help someone. Sometimes people have these long-standing grudges in their family.
Oh, yeah.
And they've gone on and on and on. It's just become chronic, and nobody's about to give way one way or the other. And, you know, people have a limited time eventually to deal with that and to resolve it somehow. And so knowing that you know, maybe they have a year or less. And if they don't do something now, they will never be able to do something to resolve the conflict with a spouse or an ex-spouse or a child. You know, it's really important for them to talk things out a little bit and to take some action. And once they take some action to overcome the stalemate and resolve things a little bit, it's like this huge weight has been lifted.
Sounds like a 12-step making amends, as long as it doesn't hurt anybody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Of actually, and so even at the Pioneer Home, because the Pioneer Home is for folks both with dementia and without, right,
mm-hmm.
who are too frail. It's a nursing home. Supportive living, would you call it supportive living? It's a
assisted living.
Assisted living.
Yeah.
Right, so you have plenty of people whose brains are functioning quite well.
Mm-hmm.
And so I imagine the conversations among 80-year-olds would be very different than the conversations among 50-year-olds.
Yeah, I think a lot of times 80-year-olds just feel like, we don't get it. You know, those people, you know, in their experience, we understand where they are because we were there one time, but they don't understand
the young.
Where we are. Yeah, the young.
The
you know,
young
we've been young,
don't
so
get
we know
it.
How the young think.
Okay, well,
but
you
the
had
young
a...
don't know how we think because we're older and they haven't been here.
Well, let me ask you. You got a real in-the-face experience with aging
mm-hmm.
when you were much younger. Because
yes.
you started this job, did it inform at all how you are living your later years?
Oh, tremendously.
How?
You realize that you really can't see the world through somebody else's eyes, that as you age and become older, your values change, your priorities change, and you really need to be respectful of people's own priorities and not try to impose your own on them. And the other thing is to do what brings joy. I was talking with a woman about traveling one time, and she said, well, what do you need to do is go to the place you want to see the most and go there first, which is kind of opposite from the way most younger people would think. They think, well, you know, I'll start easy and then kind of work up. But,
okay.
But you learn those kinds of lessons.
Yeah.
You learn that wealth really has nothing at all to do with money. Wealth has to do
oh.
with social fabric and relationships.
Ah.
And priorities just become very, very different.
So being wealthy doesn't give you an edge on aging, although a lot of people think it would because you could have more trips and more five-star hotels. But it's really about love. It's really
it
about
connectivity.
So as long as you are financially stable when you age, and not everybody is,
mm-hmm.
but as long as you are, that's all you need. You don't need
about who's going to come over and stop in and visit with you when you're feeling lonesome.
Yeah. There's been some interesting things among people my age. I'm in my late 60s, and really the discussion is a bit about should, you know, Juneau's expensive, the weather's not great, you know, you have a bad spate of weather, and then retired folks may start talking about moving down south. Well, what do you think about somebody, say, 65, picking up stakes and totally moving, not a second home, but totally moving? I mean, what do you think that? What do you think about that?
A lot of people our age do that, and I think it depends on the person. Some people do really well and manage it well, adjust well. They're the kind of people who, you know, could probably live anywhere and be happy. But, and a lot of people do it because they have family.
Yes,
somewhere,
mm-hmm.
and that makes a whole lot of sense
because mm-hmm. that increases the connectivity. The reason I mention that is obviously if you move into a new community, you especially if it's a senior community, you can make friends pretty fast because everybody's making friends. But I saw this really kind of almost scary documentary at Nickelodeon about a year and a half ago, and it was a woman whose grandmother had moved to a set of apartments that was all for seniors in Florida. You know, she was from New York and she moved to Florida. Decided to do a documentary, almost a history taking of different people. And it was bleak. I mean, the bonds were so fragile, even though they could sit and have coffee together, they had spent no time together. These are people who moved when they were pretty old. And so they were already frail. They didn't have kids, obviously. Nobody knew their kids. Most of them were widows. And when people were interviewed, as slowly individuals, of course, needed hospital care and needed help, there was nobody around to help them because everybody was old and they had no deep roots. So the thing I was thinking of, and it is, I guess, triggered by a couple of friends who have died recently in the last several years, and their community was really important in helping the couple and the families through this process. And these are people who I've known for the 30 years I've lived here, and others have known as long as those folks have lived here. And you have a deep sense of caring for these individuals, mm-hmm. which is quite different, I would think, if I met somebody a year ago. That's all. Mm-hmm. I was just thinking the social fabric would be, the roots wouldn't be very deep.
Yeah.
And a heart attack can happen in it overnight. And then, well, I don't know. I haven't heard reports from Sun City.
And if you have a sudden illness like that, then people don't have a sense of who you were before the illness. Whereas if you've been in a community for a long time, people will remember your working years, sometimes even your high school years in this town. And, you know, if you move to a new place, they only know you as an old person.
True. And they don't see the whole you.
Right.
And we want people to see the whole mm-hmm. us. I know when I'm traveling and I meet people on my travels, they have no idea of my history. And that's fun for a little while, but I wouldn't want to live with it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I just want to mention, for those listeners who have tuned in recently, that I'm Dr. Elaine Schroeder, and this is a program called Mind Over Matter. And tonight I'm in the studio live with Sandy Harris and Nils Dila, counselors whose careers have focused on aging and hospice work. And so now we'll return, and I'm going to ask Nils, what about the work you do with the decision that elders or their caregivers have to make about leaving their home?
Yeah, that I run into fairly often, and that can be a really, really tough decision. And one that needs to be made carefully and with the caregivers involved and honoring the elders' wish as much as possible. Most seniors want to stay in their home as long as possible. And there are a lot of services in Juneau to help that happen. So in-home care, personal care attendants, chore workers, when it comes time to make that decision, whether or not to leave their home, that needs to be, if possible, a group decision with the caregivers and the seniors, and taking into their wishes as much as possible. But then there's the reality, too, of physical needs and medical needs and so forth.
Well, both in my counseling practice and in my personal life, it has been very difficult. For example, with my own in-laws, who at 92 had to be dragged screaming and kicking into a supportive living facility after they had made, and they were not cognitively impaired, mm-hmm. but they had been making some inappropriate decisions around medical care, mm-hmm. basically ignoring problems, and getting them to move, and they had to move. One of the reasons they had to move is that their kids who lived in the Chicago area had to visit them every day, and it was exhausting for the kids
mm-hmm.
to do this. I mean, really, but it was very interesting. I mean, these are fine people who really care about the feelings of others, but have them move out of their place? No way.
Well,
and
it's a really scary thing.
Yeah.
You have to move out of your house and everything that you know, and you feel like you're going to be at the mercy of this institution with all these rules and...
Yeah, well, I mean, would we like it? Now,
no.
Okay, so Sandy, you have seen many people admitted to the Pioneer Home.
Mm-hmm.
You probably have tales to tell. I mean, what's that like?
Well, I was always interested in getting feedback from people about what it was like. And most people, there were people who would come in and say, oh, I'm so happy to be here. I've always wanted to be here. I don't have a second thought. Well, that would happen like once in a blue moon.
Okay. I was wondering.
Then you had people who were brought in with cognitive impairments.
Yeah.
Really didn't know what was happening very much and knew that something had changed significantly, but they weren't really sure what was going on. And they can do okay if they have enough one-to-one attention. I mean, that would be what would make the difference, is just having an anchor person there to kind of walk them through the day and reassure them.
But for most people,
you know, people who made their own decision, sort of maybe regretfully, with a little prodding from their family, they'd move in and they'd say, you know, I don't know if I've done the right thing.
Yeah.
And then 6 months later, you'd ask them and they'd say, you know, moving in was the best thing I ever did. There's just an adjustment period of learning to trust that it's okay, kind of fitting in, finding out that your fantasies about what it was going to be like are maybe just fantasies, that the reality is okay.
Well, what about the social situation? Because a client I worked with several years ago really insisted on moving out of the supportive living. She was put in supportive living down south. When I say put in, she wasn't able to do the normal functions of daily living, and she had probably very early stage dementia. But anyways, when she got into this facility, oh my gosh, she didn't like the people there. It was really not her. She was an intellectual. She was... ended up in Texas with in a conservative area of Texas with people that she couldn't politically relate to, and she was sharp enough. I mean, this really made a difference. So it was really tough on her because you have such a limited social world.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, her social world had already diminished because of her age and her disabilities. But still, she didn't like to be forced to eat with people she didn't like.
That's the job of the staff, in my mind, is to make it okay, to make it welcoming, to do some outreach. And frankly, we don't have very many options for out-of-home care for elderly people in Juneau, but I think the ones that we do, the staff are good.
You know, I think a lot of it is the connections they make if they wind up in a some kind of place like the Pioneers Home. Most of the seniors that I have worked with where the presenting problem was deciding whether or not to go into the Pioneers Home, let's say, it got to the point where living at home was so difficult, so hard, that once they got into the Pioneers Home and I did some follow-ups, the majority of those, after an adjustment period, like Sandy was saying, told me they were glad they went in there. Now, of course, their first choice would be to be independent, staying at home, taking care of themselves. But realizing that they couldn't do that, many of these have told me when they look back at what a struggle it was to keep living day to day at home, that after that adjustment period, they're glad they're in this place. But again, a lot of it has to do with the quality of the place and the staff that's there. And our Pioneers Home here is, I think, great.
Yeah. Well, so people are obviously, we're all going to grieve losing our home and losing our ability to be able to be independent. And then suddenly you're totally dependent. Well, I shouldn't say suddenly, because if somebody is ready to go into the Pioneer Home, they've probably had home health aides, or they've been living with a spouse or adult child, and they've been dependent on them. Mm-hmm. And that has been their social life. Mm-hmm. I think my experience mainly is with clients who are the adult child. And they have a parent, usually with dementia, who's had to move in with them. And it's an agonizing decision. And you two know more, way more than I do, about what the benefits are when, especially for somebody with dementia, of being in professional facility. When I was in Vancouver a couple of years ago, I met with a friend who's also a colleague, who's a psychologist who works at a Vancouver, British Columbia hospital. And, of course, the services in Canada are far better than the services we have in the United States because everyone has access to these services. They don't have to buy long-term care insurance or anything like that. And so there were marvelous free services for seniors. And she was telling me how she felt that for mid and later stage dementia, it was absolutely better for a person to be in a professional professionally supported environment, because it's so hard for family members. And the movie Nebraska that I saw last night is a perfect example of that. It was an older fellow with some kind of dementia or cognitive impairment, and his family was saying, "Hey, Dad, I told you that yesterday. Dad, are you crazy? What are you thinking of that?" They were mad at him. Mm-hmm. And he obviously had a biological illness. And I think it's hard for spouses and kids, adult children, to deal with that. And they could get angry and upset. And at a professional setting like the Pioneer Home, nobody's getting angry. I mean, the staff isn't. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think, you know, to have mom or dad or even if it's your spouse to live with you and you're in a caregiver role, it's one thing if they're basically pretty independent and they come out and they eat with you and they have their own room and they take care of themselves. And it's another thing if there's a lot of medical needs, if there's a dementia going on, mm-hmm. because caregiving then becomes an extremely challenging job. It's even when nothing's happening at the moment, you're still on as the caregiver. It's that 24/7 type of thing. And it gets to a point where for the health of the caregiver and the health of the senior, that the tough decision might have to be made, that something else has to be done. Right. And that's for the best of everyone. And getting everyone to that point, to see that point, is often a big challenge.
And there are actually two lives at stake, because when the stress and what that does to one's own longevity of being a 24-hour-a-day caregiver is horrendous.
There's all sorts of research out there that a caregiver who's taking care of a more acute type of person, they have higher incidence of heart issues, they have greater depression of their own, their longevity is less. It's just an extremely tough job. And often the person who's a caregiver is that sandwich generation. They might have a husband themselves, they might have kids themselves, and that affects their role in relation to those people too.
Right. If they're exhausted taking care of their mother or father, they don't have much room for, say, their teenage children.
Right.
If they are that
sandwich
generation. And
there's the problem of the role changes that occur.
Right.
I mean, say you have two spouses and the husband's always been kind of in charge of things, and or they've been partners, equal partners, and all of a sudden one is taking care of the other and almost takes on a parental role for the spouse.
Right.
I mean, that puts tremendous strain on the marriage. With children, adult children taking care of parents, you know, that's a terrible role reversal.
Yeah.
An older person might say, you know, I remember when she was 15 years old and she couldn't make a decision to save her life. And now she's running my life for me.
Right.
What happened?
Right.
And if people are in a professional setting, then at least the kids can be kids. They don't have to be kids and parents and guardians
and exhausted.
Caregivers and nurses and exhausted. They can just be kids and kind of, you know, solidify that role for themselves. And then they can, you know, delegate out mm-hmm. the role of nurse, caregiver, authority figure.
Yeah.
And just cherish the relationship and the time they have left together.
That's a good point. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if either of you think there's been a cultural shift, because, of course, we're living longer, and so more elders have dementia because of medical advances. People And so at the turn of the century, most people would die of, what was it, the gentleman's friend or something like that.
Pneumonia.
Pneumonia, the old person's friend. Pneumonia, or heart attack. And parents could easily live with their adult children because they would die at 65 and they wouldn't have a prolonged old age. Because even though we take a look at our life expectancy, it doesn't say the quality of the life we're getting. We're getting those extra years. So do you see any shifts from, I would say, in the direction of people being more comfortable putting their parent or their spouse in a nursing home or a supportive living facility? Do you see shifts in that direction at all, or do you?
I do. I was reading an article the other day that with Asian Americans, culturally, they have always kept their parents at home. And now that more and more Asian Americans are going into long-term care because their children work full-time and they're just not able to provide the care that they need at home. And I think it's becoming more acceptable.
Uh-huh. Okay.
You know, there's still a lot of people who are caring for their loved ones at home. But there's many factors involved now, including the economic factors. You know, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, you could maybe have a single person, a wage earner, who was making enough money. So often it was the woman, the wife, would stay home and take care of dad or mom. And now, due to economics and other cultural reasons, that just isn't the case.
Right.
Often the wife and the husband both are working, and you can't really leave mom or dad at home if they're a high needs person.
Right.
If they're not a high needs person, then it's usually not as much a problem anyhow.
Okay.
So, yes, I think there's a lot of pressures in there. You know, I don't have numbers exactly in front of me, but it wouldn't surprise me if we're heading that way.
You like know? You said, see, there are also real changes in addition to older people living longer, more dementia.
Definitely.
And it is family structure. There's more, there perhaps, I'm not sure, more divorce, more single parents, late life kids, all those changes.
And the economic pressure of both adults in the household
and
having no
women,
work.
Women working.
Yeah.
And the other thing that has changed significantly in the last 30 years is the quality of the long-term care facilities.
You're right.
People used to be horrified at the idea of going to a nursing home because it meant being tied into a wheelchair and stuck out in the hallway of screaming old people all day long. Well, you know, it isn't like that anymore. There have been a lot of advances in regulations.
Promise?
And
do you promise, Sandy?
We're getting
really?
It all fixed up for when we get old.
Okay. Oh, great. Why don't we take a short music break? Okay. Are my technicians ready for that?
Oh,
Welcome back to Mind Over Matter. For those listeners who've just tuned in, I'm Dr. Elaine Schroeder, and I'm in the studio tonight live with Sandy Harris and Nels Dila, two professional counselors who combined have worked for decades with Juno's aging population. And during this next part of the show, what we're going to explore are ways that counseling can help with the aging process, with grieving, and with taking care of an aging or ill family elder. So let's just talk, let's put our heads together, and even when we're talking about counseling, this would also be a self-help issue, too, for those of you out there in the listening audience who happen to be getting older, and who would like some thoughts on good ways to deal with it. So, Nels, you mentioned something that touched on what you told me was called reminiscence therapy.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Reminiscence therapy, I use a kind of modified form of that. A little earlier in the show here, I talked about how I mentioned that in later life, many times people are looking back over their life and they're trying to figure out, you know, what was it worth? How did I do? Did I do the right job by my child, by my husband, and so forth? And reminiscence therapy is where you allow the person to talk, and it just kind of, if you just kind of walked in, you would say, well, they're just talking about when back in the good old days. Isn't that kind of boring? Well, what they're really doing is they're looking back and they're trying to see, what they did. How was my life? Was it worthwhile? And my job is to kind of help them, if they start getting too negative, to try to get them to reframe, look at it a little differently and see that, hey, you know what? Yeah, I did do okay and I did the best I could. And, you know, and if they can come away eventually feeling that, yeah, you know, I did all right. It kind of helps them come to the conclusion that, you know, my life was worthwhile, and that things overall were good, and that, hey, you know what, I'm an okay person.
Well, another part of that reminiscence therapy that you're mentioning, I think, would be seeing your life as a whole, seeing a pattern in your life, seeing,
sure.
Oh yeah, okay, I did this and I did that. I just had an experience. My husband and I were visiting in Miami a dear old friend who was in our Peace Corps group. My husband and I were Peace Corps volunteers together decades and decades ago in India, and we've kept close touch with some friends, interestingly, two of whom have died recently. So we were there with a good friend and her husband, and we were reminiscing, and we were talking about all these things because we were in our very early 20s, and it was an amazing time. But I realized how upbeat that felt, how we really loved it, because there wasn't anybody else we could talk to about this who had been there. Mm-hmm. So we had to fly all the way to Miami to be able to find somebody who knew what we were talking about. And it felt really, really good. And I would imagine high school reunions, anytime you get together with old friends. And I've noticed a increased interest, I would say, in reconnecting with childhood friends, friends from earlier parts of my life, or even earlier parts of the time I've lived in Juneau, and they've moved away. And it just seems like it makes me feel whole, like complete.
Yeah. I hear what you're saying. You know, I right now I'm just thinking through my mind about a number of seniors when I first came to maybe have our first session. When I first met them, you walk in and it's kind of this sad-looking elderly man or woman sitting in her trailer or little apartment. And you start talking with them, and pretty soon you start talking about the past, and they start talking about how they were in the service and things they did during their college days or how they raised their children. And all of a sudden they just almost start glowing a little bit. And they start, you know, it's so easy, I think, as we get older to start focusing on our losses. And sometimes it takes another person to kind of help them see, well, like, oh, you know, you're right. I did start that business up, and I did raise my children, you know, I was good to my wife or whatever. And all of a sudden, you know, that mood starts changing a little bit, and they start seeing themselves or, hey, you know what? Yeah, I'm getting older, but things are happening. But you know what? I did do some of these things, and I am all right.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that's why a relative of ours who is in his late 80s keeps going to, he actually organizes these World War II reunions of his buddies that were in the same battalion, and they all meet every year.
Mm-hmm.
And it's this whole continuity starting from a time that was where they were very impressionable when they were young recruits in World War II.
And when you listen to those guys and whoever is reconnecting, you know, they're not talking about the terrible times that happened.
No.
Even when they had terrible times. They're talking about the funny thing that happened.
The terrible times, as long as you survive them, become the funny stories. I mean, the greatest challenge is if you've ever heard somebody retell a trip they took, a long trip. Things have to be messed up a little bit to have a really good story. Because it is how you overcome obstacles.
Yeah.
That become interesting later on. If everything goes smoothly, no, it's not as much fun. Any comments on that, Sandy?
Yeah, it's almost like, you know, people have all these losses when they get older, but if they can talk with people and remember, then they haven't really lost that part of themselves or that part of their lives. Because they're still...
Good point.
You know, at 80, 85, 90, whatever, they're still the same person that went into the Army and went into combat and raised kids and, you know, started a business or whatever. They know that, I'm a capable, competent person.
What about loneliness? I would think loneliness from, first of all, America is plagued with loneliness because of our constant mobility compared to cultures where people stay pretty much in the same place for most of their lives. But what about loneliness? Because people's friends die.
Mm-hmm.
If you're the last man standing, you may be the only man standing. Nobody's around, and you are... What are your thoughts on that?
And you know, that's something I have to add into my work. I try to use a holistic approach. And you're right. You know, as people get older, their friends are... passing on,
they're widowed.
They're widowed. Their spouses are no longer alive. The people they used to go to church with, a lot of them are no longer there. So then, part of the challenge of working with folks like that is, you know, like in other areas of our lives, we have to adapt. And so one of the things in old age we have to adapt to is the fact that there's people leaving and. You could become lonely.
And you could do something about it.
Exactly.
I mean, especially if they're still living on their own. They're old, but they're physically capable of driving and getting out and about. Obviously, and I noticed this with I'm at the time when people are retiring and some of those retirees are moving away. These are good friends who are moving away. What I realize is I have to make new friends.
Exactly. And
I can't rest on my laurels here.
Exactly. And that's part of that holistic approach. You get them out to start socializing. You hook them up with a caravan service or something. They
yeah.
start going back to church.
Yes.
You get them exercising. Physical activity, we haven't touched on that yet, but that is an extremely big part to adapting to older age.
And so keeping somebody active, first of all, it's a deterrent possibly to cognitive decline. And
also to falling and physical decline.
Of course, falling.
Okay, you have to
so stay strong. moving.
Yeah, and it also affects our mood, our brains, our endorphins.
Oh, yes.
It's good for all of that, physical, emotional, social.
And if you're depressed and lonely and by yourself, you generally don't have a whole lot of motivation to make yourself exercise. I mean,
it can be a downward spiral if you
yeah.
don't break out of it.
Well, I've noticed the aging of the Juno Racquet Club. Really, because
yeah.
I now, since I'm self-employed, I, of course, avoid the busy hours at the Racquet Club. And so I'm there at 10 o'clock in the morning or 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And we're all there together. I see you, Sandy, all
mm-hmm.
the time.
It's a social activity.
It's a social activity,
yeah.
but it's also, it's really funny because it's definitely, you know why everybody's there. Like, we got to keep this body going.
That's
and
right.
we're going to, you know. And as a friend of mine joked today, actually, she said, well, it's lucky I'm retired because it's taking me so much time to take care of my body. You know, she's got to put her hearing aids in and her eyeglasses on and her false teeth in. And then she's got to go exercise. Things you didn't have to do when you were 50, perhaps. So it sounds like you're doing some real working on behavioral changes
right.
with some of your elderly clients. More socialization, getting out there, making suggestions, hooking them up with caravan, making sure they don't drop out of activities. For example, you mentioned church. Yeah, so people, you know, the pastor changes. There's new people in church. Their old friends aren't there. No, maybe they don't want to go. Worst thing they could do
mm-hmm.
is to stop going.
Mm-hmm.
So it's partly being a coach, too.
Yeah.
Kind of just encouraging them to keep going.
Yeah, yeah. I would say probably for me, when I'm working with elders and working with my elderly self or my older self, me, it's acceptance therapy. I'm calling it therapy, but you could just say acceptance.
Sure.
It's a type of cognitive restructuring. Mm-hmm. It's learning to be present with what is. And I think the Dalai Lama said something like, the measure of our unhappiness is the distance between the way things actually are and the way we want them to be. And this has nothing to do with not being able to change your social life or get up and exercise if you can. It is the old serenity prayer.
Yep.
Change the things you can, but learn to accept those things you can't change. And I
have the wisdom to know the difference.
And have the wisdom to know the difference. And I think that that's one of the, when I have worked over the years with people with early stage Alzheimer's, I think it's the biggest hard, I mean, what a challenge to accept the fact that you have diminishing cognitive functions.
Mm-hmm.
Or somebody with Parkinson's, or somebody with ALS, and then put all of us with aging, because we're all moving towards death. And that's a huge acceptance.
Yeah.
That's an area of acceptance. Someday we will be no more.
Yeah. And you brought up a really good point. I facilitate a Parkinson's support group once a month. And, you know, you accept that you have these things. You accept that your knees are hurting or that you have Parkinson's or that you can't run the 110 flat. You accept that, but you don't give in to it in the sense that you do what you can. So if you can't run, you walk.
Yes.
If you can't walk very well, you swim, whatever
mm-hmm.
it is. So you accept the fact that you're having limitations, but then you do what you can with what you have.
Right.
And you keep your attitude up.
Yeah, in some ways, it's all about adapting to a loss of control.
It is.
I mean, as we go through life, we realize that we just don't have that much control over much of anything. Although, you know, we may have thought we did, And it becomes more and more apparent that, you know, I really don't have any control. And that's a hard thing to accept, especially in our culture.
Another thing we don't have, and that is knowing exactly what's going to happen to us.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't know if you're a married couple and who's going to die first, who's going to be widowed. You don't know how long you're going to live, so you don't know exactly how much money you need. You don't know what's going to get you. You don't know what's going to happen, and letting go of don't know. And that's a type of control that we used to think we had. I think when we were younger, we weren't going to die. Our spouse wasn't going to die. Our children weren't going to die before us, and so on, because we had eternal health, youth, and beauty.
And money,
because we were always making it if we were still working. We weren't on fixed incomes.
But as you get older, it becomes more clear to you in many ways. I mean, when you really can't control your eyesight. When it starts to go, it starts to go.
Yes.
You can't control your hearing. You can't control whether or not you can run a 100-yard dash. Sometimes you can't control whether or not you can go up the steps.
And speaking of which, I think Dolly, our technical assistant, asked me if I was taking this weightlifting class, and I discovered that I can't do the squats because it hurts my knees. So then I go into the orthopedist, and he says, bone on bone, you know, the classic, right? Bone on bone, arthritis. And I said, well, am I going to need a knee replacement? And he goes, well, maybe. And I go, well, how soon? And he says, I don't know, between 10 and 12 years, or 2 and 12 years. Mm-hmm. And I thought, okay. Mm-hmm. So that's another unknown. Mm-hmm. You have no idea. No idea what's going to happen. And we're not used to that. And
no.
It becomes, I think, more apparent as we get older. And maybe one of the reasons that aging is associated with wisdom is because we learn over time, when the real big ones come, that we have to let go. And just like in Tuesdays with Maury, acceptance, acceptance, acceptance. I remember what he said to Mitch, the author, who said, how can you handle this, Maury? You know, because basically Maury was dying from the toes up, as can happen with ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease. And he said, well, I wake up in the morning, and I give myself a good 10 minutes to feel sorry for myself, and then I say, okay, get over it. Let's move on with the day.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, you only got some time. A certain amount of time left. So really, there's also that impetus. And this is interesting, and I think there's really some concrete things we can do about aging beyond exercising and even acceptance. And that is familiarize ourselves. Don't be in denial, like all of a sudden it's hitting you. You know, the joke about, there was a joke like about, you know, a 95-year-old woman being given a terminal diagnosis, and she raised her hands and said, why me, oh Lord, or something like that, why me? So really just getting, I read literature, I know I'm in the field because I lead the bereavement group, but I read books on aging, and I do that for myself because I kind of want to get it. And I think it's, even though it's a very good practical matter to take care of our advanced care directives, for medical care, which is a big deal to do that. You want to give it a lot of thought. When I say big deal, I don't mean to say you shouldn't do it and it's going to take forever. Just go online and get the form from the state of Alaska. But it's really important. Your will, talking to adult kids and relatives, and even writing your own obituary. That may sound painful, but it starts getting you more into the point of accepting.
I think it's freeing to do those things.
Yeah, yeah. Now, we are just about over. And we're running out of time, and the reason is because we've been having such a great discussion. And I want to thank Nils, Dila, and Sandy Harris so much for coming in. And also, I want to give huge thanks to John and Dolly Kramers, who are technical support. And I've been doing this with John and Dolly for years and years. So good night, and tune in next month.
Good night.
Good night.